tell you something else that's really important when you look at how they build teamwork and camaraderie is it's often under grade three fun. When you're doing something that doesn't feel like any fun at the time, but you're learning all about yourself. And that comes from doing things like adventure training, putting people in really uncomfortable positions. It comes from escape and evasion training, where you're being hunted by a hunter force. When you're not eating food for 10 days, you're really low, or you're really, really exhausted, you're tired, you're fatigued, your stress levels are through the roof. That's when you need your friends. And that's what they gave us by actually putting us through our paces when the times were getting tough.
Welcome. Perhaps you can recall having a leader who took credit for everything that you did that was successful, only they took credit for it because it was on their watch. And maybe they even found somebody to blame when things went wrong. However, as humans, we love to do this. We go from a culture of blame to, we polarize to a culture of no blame. And of course, that doesn't play out so well because often people will abdicate responsibility. So like so many things in contemporary times, we need to find the middle ground. But as great an idea as that is, you may be wondering, what might that look like in the real world of leadership? Is there such thing as a just culture that creates an environment where people feel safe to speak openly about mistakes, that kind of fosters trust and learning and continuous improvement? Well, according to our next guest, Mandy Hixon, the best-selling author of An Officer, Not a Gentleman, there certainly is. Mandy Hixon was the first woman to fly a Tornado GR4 on the front line, completing three tours of duty and 45 combat missions over Iraq. Mandy Hixon says it's not only possible to build a just culture, but it's highly practical. Welcome to the Dov Barron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the learning. I'm your host, Dov Barron, and I advise high-performing organizations on how to harness their emotional source code to transform their tribe. Our guest today is Mandy Hixon. Mandy has over 30 years' experience with aviation. She joined the Royal Air Force in 1994 and was the first woman to fly a Tornado GR4 on the front line, where she patrolled in hostile environments, including patrolling the no-fly zone over Iraq. Since leaving the RAF, she has retrained as a facilitator and coach in human factors, where she draws on her experience of calculated risk-taking, decision-making under pressure, and the critical role of humans in the system to transform vivid lessons from the cockpit to management and leadership context. As an aviation ambassador for the Department of Transport, trustee of the Royal Air Force Charitable Trust, and a fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society, she continues to inspire the next generation to pursue STEM-related endeavors in a career in aviation. In recent years, she's completed expeditions to summit of Kilimanjaro and a base camp of Everest. Mandy is now a highly in-demand keynote speaker. Today, she shares her insights with some of the most successful organizations across the world, where she describes the strategies and behaviors that can be adopted when stakes are at their absolute highest. More on Mandy in a moment. You're tuned into the Dov Barron Show. Each episode is an exploration into the minds that shape the world. Every episode is a raw, unscripted collaboration between my guests and me as we dive into the undiscovered truths about leadership that few dare to admit. We find guests for you who are sometimes unknown to the general public, but absolute titans in their field, the kinds of people that high-profile leaders turn to when they need an edge. If you're the kind of leader who craves depth over soundbites, hit that subscribe button right now, because this is where real leaders come to sharpen their edge. Please turn up the volume and help me to welcome best-selling author of An Officer, Not a Gentleman, and her new book, An Officer and Her Gentleman, Mandy Hixon. Welcome, Mandy.
Thanks so much, Dov. An absolute pleasure to be here with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. We took a while to get here.
We certainly did. I think we first had this conversation about 18 months ago. So, yeah.
You're a busy lady, that's for sure. Now, you've achieved more than I think most people can imagine. And those who've endeavored to achieve often find their achievements change form, or the value of them gets diluted as they get further along that path. What does real success mean to you?
It's a great question, actually. And I think the honest answer would be to have an impact. And I was really delving down recently, actually, into looking at, you know, what is my driving force? And the thing behind it is to basically leave any situation, be that a speech, be that some facilitation work, be it working with young people, to have an impact and create positive change as an outcome of what I've done.
So what does that mean, impact? Because, again, that's one of those vague and positive impact. All right, well, you know, I blew you a kiss. It was a positive impact. I know you're about more than that. So that's why I want to just push a little deeper on that.
Yeah. So the big thing for myself would be the fact that when you're at the vanguard of change, you are creating this role model. And I think when I left the Air Force, I assumed I would do what every other pilot does. Let's be honest, when they leave the military, the way that they can earn money is to go into the airlines, because you haven't earned a huge amount serving your country, I'll be honest. And you think, well, that's great. I can earn some money. And so that's what you do. And in that moment, when I was going to go into that world, I thought I had no desire to do this. And I was flying at the time with a young girl, and I was doing this as a volunteer. I would go back at the weekends to fly young cadets, and I was flying with this girl. And at the end of the flight, she turned to me and she said, I want to be a pilot just like you. And these three words created this momentous feeling within me of actually wanting to change my direction completely, because I had literally just got my license to be a pilot. And in that moment, I thought, right, that's what I want to do. I want to take a different journey completely. I want to inspire others, and I want to be that role model for others to be able to follow. And it did start initially at schools, but that positive impact is the fact that you can leave that room, and if I can just change the mind of one young person to say, I want to do something different with my life as a consequence of hearing what I have to say, then to me, that is success.
Was flying something that was sort of always with you? Is that something you had a desire for as a kid?
Yeah. So, I mean, my grandpa was a pilot in the Air Force, and I'd grown up hearing his stories, I think. But when I was 30, I mean, I was growing up in Northern England in Manchester, and, you know, you're not exactly surrounded by inspiration in that area of the world.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
No idea whatsoever. Yeah. But I joined the Air Cadets, and it's a club run by the RAF, and you can join at the age of 13. And I remember going flying actually near Liverpool. And I said to the pilot, excuse me, sir, do you get paid for this? And he just looked at me and he laughed and he said, well, of course I do, because this is my job. It's my career. But he said, but it's also my passion. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anyone linking these magic words of passion, a career, purpose in one sentence. And it was at that moment I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to become a fast jet pilot in the Air Force.
I know that when I talked about leaving Manchester, everybody thought I was nuts.
Why would you want to leave? I mean, it's an amazing place.
You're going to leave Man United, Man City. You're going to leave fish and chips. You're going to leave the pub. Like, you're going to leave your family. And it was just outrageous. And I was looking to travel the world and study in different countries and be a business person. What I was doing was insane. What you were talking about doing seemed doubly so. What was that like around you? Because I know the pushback I got.
Well, it was probably even more so than that, actually, Dov, because women weren't allowed to be pilots. So there I was stating that this was what I was going to do, but it was an impossible dream because it didn't exist. Actually, I was very lucky. I had real support from my family, from my mum. She was a single mum and she had brought up two girls to be very strong, independent young women. She was fully behind me. And she used to say, if it's going to be someone, Mandy, that changes this whole process, it's going to be you. And so that was a really positive encouragement. And I actually ended up taking every leadership role as a young person so that if they ever changed the rules, I was then in the right position for it. And that's exactly what I did. I literally, from the age of about 13, I ended up leading almost every single organisation I was a part of. And even when I got to university, I went through university, I joined another club, University Air Squadron. I ended up being their chair as well and gained 160 hours of flying when I was there.
Wow. A lot of that stuff just seems like crazy to that world. I know, like I said, I know that people just didn't believe me when I said those things. They just couldn't believe I would even do those things. And I don't know about for you, but for me, I went back after I'd been gone, I think 4 years. And I remember thinking, oh yeah, I'll go and see if the lads are in the pub. And they were sitting at exactly the same table in the pub, in the Bluebell pub in Mountain Green. And one of the guys said to me, he said this, I was wearing a white shirt, it was summertime, I was wearing a white shirt. And he said to me, your shirts were always whiter. And I said, what does that mean? He goes, there was just something about you that was always brighter. And I was like, That's really interesting because I never felt like I fitted in. I didn't feel like I belonged there. I felt like I belonged somewhere else. But it was like there is a gravitational force to remain in the environment. For you, not only wanting to be a pilot, but wanting to do the impossible, which is be a female pilot, and then going on to fly the Tornado. So tell us a little bit about that, because that in itself is fascinating.
Yeah, it was an interesting journey, actually. When they changed the rules, I applied to join and I went through the full selection process and I failed every single computer-based aptitude test to be a pilot. I had my private pilot's license by now. I had 160 hours of military flying as well within the air squadron at university. And you can only ever take the test twice in your life. So I waited a year. I went back, resat them. I failed them again, Dov. That should have been the end of the line. And this is what one of the first real forays that I had into what true leadership meant to me. There was a boss of this club that I was a member of, and I didn't fail the test and come back and he said, well, you failed the test, therefore you're no good. He said, but Mandy, you're a best performing pilot. What's wrong with the tests? And he was a middle manager. He had no need to do this. And he decided to tackle the Air Force on their recruiting policies. And he demanded a full investigation. And on doing so, they found out that 70% of women taking these tests were failing them outright. And about 70% of men were passing them. So we've got an unconscious bias that's now been uncovered because they'd never been tested on women before. And he didn't stop there, though. He asked external examiners to come and fly with me. They all graded me as above average. And so now we've got evidence saying that I could fly and computer-based tests saying I couldn't. And the Air Force offered me a commission then to become an air traffic controller, which I didn't want to do that job. But again, under his advice, it was that feeling of, Mandy, a foot in the door is better than none. Once you're in, we will make your case. But if you don't even accept that, they're not going to take you on in that first level. So you've got to be in to make your case. And it was a really good lesson of, I hate to use the cliche of like turning a stepping stone, you know, which felt like a stumbling block at the time, but creating a launch pad. But it was also that feeling of, what does resilience mean to you? Because you might fail, but it was about taking a completely sideways track to get to the goal that I wanted to get to. And once I was in, I wrote hundreds of letters and emails of the modern world. And eventually I got a letter back and it just said, Dear Flying Officer Wells, which was my name at the time, the RAF will give you your branch change to pilot. And I was like, yes, I've broken them. And then it said, we are, however, taking you on as a test case to find out how far through the flying training system someone with no aptitude can get before they fail. And that was another interesting lesson. Because, of course, if you tell somebody that they will fail, even if they are a very confident young person, they're going to plant a seed of doubt. And that was going to become a really big psychological barrier.
So how old are you at this time, if you don't mind me asking?
21 years old.
So at 21, you're so easily swayed. And you can be like I was at 21, which is pissy attitudinal. Tell me I can't and I will. Were you that so?
Well, I was incredibly confident. However, if you're told in black and white by a leading authority that you will fail at some point, that has now planted this seed of doubt that wasn't there before. Every time I'd struggle on a flight, your default setting will always be, well, it's because you're not good enough, you will fail. And if you're the only woman going through that training and you're already feeling that you are slightly isolated in that as well, you feel that that highlight is going to be really on you at every single stage. And it was really tricky. And I nearly let it get the better of me until I was very much through the final stages of my fast jet training. And I was three trips away from graduating and I failed a flight. And I took it again and I failed it again. And now I was in this horrible spiral of loss of confidence. And I was doing something called battle turns. And it's basically, if you can imagine Top Gun Maverick, when they're flying down the valley, you know, that scene where you've got a wingman, someone's trying to come behind you to shoot you down. And you've always got this blind spot when you're flying. It's always directly behind your jet, a bit like in business, you know, always waiting for someone, the opposition, to get the better of you. But the person that's got a sight on that is your wingman. And that's why they're there, is to check your six. And actually, I was failing the thing called battle turns, which is when you've basically got to think ahead, strategize, and actually plan where you're going to turn. Because if you just turn to the left, you're behind each other. And so we plan ahead and we use geometry to dictate that when we roll out, you'll beam each other. And I was failing this. I just couldn't see the bigger picture. I was so caught up in the minutiae of it. I was basically just getting worse and worse. And the night before my CHOP ride, the guys on my course, there were 12 of them, but one of them knocked on my door and just said, "Mandy, we're taking you out." And I thought, absolutely not. Anyway, he took me down to the bike sheds, even more concerning. We got on, that's probably a very British joke, but we got onto our bikes and we cycled to the other side of the airfield, and the rest of the course were there. They'd stuck wings on their bikes and they would now spend the next few hours cycling up and down this parade square, sort of yelling 30 left, 60 right, and doing all the maneuvers. I was failing in the air, but on the ground. And everything just fell into place because guess what? It was a visual picture. I had been doing it same way, same day, same results. And they gave me cognitive diversity. We always focus, don't we, on gender and cultural diversity. But to me, it's about thinking differently. And they gave me that different perspective that night. I flew the trip the next day and it went well. I passed the course and my instructor looked at me and said, "What happened overnight? You were basically like flying with a different pilot. You had a different mindset from the moment you got the briefing." And I told him what the guys had done. And he just said, "It's unbelievable, Mandy. You're in competition with each other. There are six spaces for this course. And congratulations, you're number seven. So one of your course mates has just jeopardized his own career advancement by about a year to potentially get you through." And in that moment, again, this is your second big lesson of life, was what it felt like to be part of an incredible team. But that thread that ran through it was going to be trust. And it's that, basically, what underpins any team when you're building trust is going to be, why is someone doing the actions that they're doing? And if it's for selfless reasons, trust always goes through the roof. And they gave me that night.
There's so much to unpack there, because first of all, is the piece of, are you learning in the way that works for you? Or are you learning in the way that you've been told you should learn? And if you are in any way cognitively diverse, and by that, I don't mean autistic, although it could be that, but it could be as simple as ADHD or dyslexic or whatever it is. It's a very big spectrum. Are you learning in a way that allows you to learn? Because sometimes you're not, and it's not that you're thick, as we would call it. It just means that you're not getting it in a way that it needs to be delivered for you. And that on the bikes thing was a great example of that. Then on top of that, there's the lesson of building a team of people who will support you, even at their own cost, and potentially at their own cost, to build that. Here's what I wonder is, did you recognize that you needed to learn in a different way before they did that? And second of all, did you realize that you'd built that level of trust with those team members that they would even potentially jeopardize themselves in order to assist you?
Well, it's two really good questions. Firstly, I did not know. No. Because I did not have the foresight, and I did not basically probably have that diversity of thought myself, because I'd just been doing it in the same way in the same day. But I could tell you something else. When you look at the military and you look at high performing teams, that trust piece that they talk about is really important. And when I was going through this stage of flying training, I'd been in the Air Force for 4 years by now. And I felt that I really wanted some of my own space, Dov. And so I'd contacted the station commander and said, "I don't want to live on the base anymore. I'd like to be able to rent my own flat and live off base." I got a flat refusal saying, "Absolutely not. When you're going through a flying training course like this, you need your teammates. You need your course mates around you to help you if you struggle." And I thought, rubbish, absolute rubbish. And then about a month later, this happens. So basically, if he'd allowed me to live off base, I would not have actually passed the course to become a fast jet pilot. And so it's that feeling of recognizing when you as a leader, i.e. the station commander at that point, had to step in and say, "Mandy, you do not have the knowledge that we have of how you build teams." And being in the military, building that trust is absolutely essential, because if you think about it, these are the people you're going to go to war with, and you need to guarantee that they will be doing the best of their ability. They won't be taking a shortcut. They'll be talking openly about mistakes and all of those sorts of things. That comes from trust.
But my question is, did you realize that you had built that trust, or was it just a cultural environment that built that trust? What I wonder is, would they have done that for somebody else?
Yeah, and I think they did do it. I think the course was incredibly strong. We'd been with these set of people now for about 3 years going through that flying training program. A few changes on each course as you're going through, but the core group of us were there. These were my brothers in arms. And actually, we would have gone to the end of the earth for each other, I think. And that comes from living, breathing, sleeping the same air as these people, not sleeping together. You're literally living under the same roof as these people. And I'll tell you something else that's really important when you look at how they build teamwork and camaraderie is it's often under grade 3 fun. When you're doing something that doesn't feel like any fun at the time, but you're learning all about yourself. And that comes from doing things like adventure training, putting people in really uncomfortable positions. It comes from escape and evasion training, where you're being hunted by a hunter force when you're not eating food for 10 days. You're really low, or you're really, really exhausted. You're tired, you're fatigued, your stress levels are through the roof. That's when you need your friends. And that's what they gave us by actually putting us through our paces when the times were getting tough.
Let's transfer this into the context of leadership, particularly in the business world, because we're not sending out hunting parties for the CEO or for the CFO or for anybody. Maybe we should. I've met many who need that. So how does that translate into the leadership world?
So I think whenever I get asked to go and speak to businesses, one of the main areas they all want to talk about is culture. And they look at culture within not just the military, but within aviation as a whole. And that often culture is set with the tone at the top. So it stems around authenticity, around open leadership, but it also sets around actually talking openly about mistakes. And I think that's something that I think you and I were really wanting to hone in a little on, talk about.
Yes.
So I'll give you an example. In the late 1990s, or early 1990s, sorry, we were losing a lot of aircraft. Aircraft were crashing and yet technology was improving. So this did not correlate, because if you think about technology is improving, surely our accident rate would be going down because the aircraft are becoming safer. And we were finding out that the accident rate was going up. And so they realized at this point that one of the things that they often used to hear was not just what is the aircraft doing now, so this level of being outside of automation, but also the fact that we were seeing huge breakdowns in leadership hierarchies, in decision making, in other words, in human error. And so they realized they had to do something about it, and they developed a program called Crew Resource Management. And it covered 16 key areas, from everything from situational awareness to threat and error management, communication skills, leadership, teamwork, and all of these things in between. Culture was a big one. They realized that they had in the aviation world a completely flawed culture, because nobody was ever learning. If you got away with something, you kept quiet about it. So if you think about, for every one major event that happens, and for us, sadly, in the aviation world, that's often loss of life, you will have 30 near misses where a report goes in because there was a really negative outcome, but it was no one dying, let's say. So you'll have 130 beneath your surface line. You will have 300 times where someone got away with it. Now, studies have been done by Bird, by Heinrich, and they've looked at different organizations, from high risk industries to aviation to railway, oil and gas. And they've almost come out with exactly this same error pyramid: 130, 300. So if you have the right culture, and the culture is set at the top, tone at the top, and actually it says, we openly want to know about things, then you're not always going to be reacting to the big one that happens. You're going to start to get the information on the 300. And now we can be more proactive. And that's what they realized they were missing. Because they had a blame culture where people never talked about things, they missed everything. So everything was just a reaction. And so they decided to move away from the blame culture and develop something called the no blame culture. Well, that should surely work. Of course it doesn't, because there's got to be accountability. And there's also, someone's going to violate. Where's the line in the sand? They finally had this seesaw effect, and they finally came up with the term of a just culture, which we often hear about now. I know certainly within my world, but also within business. But they came up with the statement of a just culture is a culture that recognizes that competent professionals make mistakes, and also will develop unhealthy norms. And that could be in the form of routine rule violations or shortcuts, but there is zero tolerance for recklessness. So there's my line. Anything to the left of that, I want to know about it, because human nature will dictate that you will always take a shortcut if you can. You might not mean to, but you might find that you find an easier way of doing something from A to B. And suddenly you're no longer going from A to B, but you're going from A to B1. And that practical drift that we see coming in starts to become the new norm. Well, that drift is where errors happen. because actually you're operating outside of your, let's say, box of standards. And so this is what they wanted to capture: unhealthy norms, shortcuts, rule violations, those sorts of things, but they wanted to have reports on it. Now, after that program was developed, we saw the accident rate go down year on year on year. And you can actually map how much trust there was in an organization as to the origin of the reports that come in. So we often used to see that the reports would come in and they would all initially, while they're testing out the system, be about things. So it might be, let's give it the aviation context, it might be saying the reason the aeroplane crashed was because I had the radar was not working well. So I'm blaming something and I want to see, does anything happen as a consequence? It could be there's never any toilet rolls and it distracts me. I want to shout about irrelevancies, but I also want to test the system. If I get feedback and that feedback loop is now complete, someone's listened to me, acted on it. When somebody else now makes a mistake, I'm moving from this baby era of shouting for attention into the teenage years, where I'm now saying, well, actually, the reason the aeroplane crashed was because Dov gave me a really poor handover. And actually, I wasn't very slick on it. And therefore, he is to blame. Does the just culture apply to you? And if it applies to you, and I see that, my trust is now built. So the next time I make a mistake, I then say, I am the origin of the report. I made this mistake and I want to tell you about it because I believe and I trust in the organization. And when you start to get those origin number three, i.e. the I, you know that you've hit maturity.
This is a very important piece, which I think we'll explore more in the second half. In my company, we do a lot of cultural work. And one of the foundational pieces I talk about is everybody talks about emotional intelligence. That's important. It's very important. But unfortunately, as my friend Joshua Freeman, who runs 6 Seconds, which is the largest emotional intelligence training company in the world, says the problem with emotional intelligence is it often lacks intelligence and emotion because it becomes something that people regurgitate.
Yeah.
And my answer to that is it's not emotional intelligence as such, it's emotional maturity.
Yeah.
To apply the emotional intelligence or the lack of emotional intelligence. And what it seems like you're talking about is a maturity level that goes up. And I really want to sort of explore more into that, building that into this just culture as we move into the second half of the show. Before we do that, this has been a great conversation. I want to make sure that we keep diving in deeper. Tell people where they can find out more about you, about your books, booking you for speaking engagements, etc. as well.
Yeah, so the best way to get in touch with me is through my website, which is www.mandyhickson.com. So nothing too tricky on that one. All my books are available on Amazon as well. So my second book is about to launch in November, but they will be available for pre-sale literally from next week. I'm not sure, depending on when we go out, but I'm sure we'll be able to tweak that. But that one's going to be called An Officer and Her Gentleman, and it's written in collaboration with my husband, who is very cognitively diverse. And so we have got two very different perspectives. So it's basically two aviators, two different cockpits, but one journey.
Oh, that's very fascinating. All right, we're going to be back for more on this delicious conversation with Mandy Hickson in just one click. So stay curious, my friends, stay curious, and we'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to part two of our delicious conversation with our guest, Mandy Hickson. She is an aviation ambassador for the Department of Transport. She is a trustee of the Royal Air Force Charitable Trust, a fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society. She has flown in combat. She was the first pilot to fly the Tornado GR4. She did the impossible. She became that pilot when women couldn't even become pilots. If you, for some reason, didn't catch part one and you really want to understand how that journey went, it's truly fascinating. I really encourage you to do it. And we were talking about how this has evolved into culture, because now she's a very highly in-demand speaker and trainer around the world. She's brought out to some of the largest companies in the world. Her last book was called An Officer, Not a Gentleman, because she was the first female officer flying that particular plane. And now her new book is called An Officer and Her Gentleman, which she has co-written with her husband. And as you said at the last part, was it? You said one cockpit, two pilots or something?
Yeah, so two aviators, two cockpits, but one journey.
Yeah, that's, so it's really fascinating. So where we finished up in the last part of this podcast of part one, we talked about building this culture and we talked about emotional intelligence, but emotional maturity, getting from the blame to the no blame to the taking responsibility, taking accountability, because a lot of it as an idea is lovely, but oftentimes people don't have the emotional maturity. And you, I'm sure, have seen this as much as I have, that somebody in a very, very powerful role might be about 12 years old emotionally. They can be intellectually brilliant, strategically brilliant at what it is they do, but they lack the emotional maturity. This is where I want to go with you, is asking you, when you're confronted with dealing with that, so you've got this executive team, you've got somebody who's strategically brilliant, who has created a lot of value for the company at a level of strategy, but has created this culture that's, put it simply, toxic because they lack emotional maturity. Where do you go with that?
So it's a really interesting one, isn't it? And you will often see that somebody who is a strategist is often perhaps maybe they're on a level of spectrum, who knows? They are very focused, but they're brilliant at the strategy. But they will often be the ones lacking that emotional intelligence that we need. And so when you look at, say, a team, and especially a senior leadership team, let's look at the SLT, that's where it's so important that we do have diversity of thought on that team. Because if you just surround yourselves with people who are very like you and you create that echo chamber, it can be a very pleasant place to work, in as much as nobody challenges, but nobody therefore will give you different results. And so when you are looking at that team, I think one of the most important things to do is to just to be really, really open. And I think you touched on that word, psychological safety. But when you're talking about a senior leadership team, there should be psychological safety at that level, without a doubt. Surely they should feel empowered to speak up, to challenge. But it very much depends on how open that person is and how basically they're setting that tone. So when we're running missions, for example, in the military, we would literally take our epaulets off and we say, leave your stripes at the door. And I just think it's this really great analogy to say, you know what, there's no hierarchy in here. We want a really honest, flat structure. And that can be as simple as where we sit around a table. If you're going to be in that table as well, why do we always have it that the person at the head of the table feels that that's it, they're all powerful, and the person at the far end doesn't feel they've got a voice? So think about where we're sitting. Also making sure we surround ourselves with people with more emotional intelligence than ourselves, if that is an area we're lacking. Richard Branson would be an absolute classic one for this. Very emotionally intelligent man, but realised that he said yes to everything. So guess what? He surrounded himself with people who said no. And it had to go through the no group before it would be allowed to go through, because he recognised where his weaknesses were. And so that's the whole point. I think when we run programmes in leadership development, or we look at, say, Myers-Briggs or a more modern one, or Insights, or whatever the profile you are looking at, recognising very much where you are on that spectrum, and making sure that the gaps in your team are done on competencies and emotional intelligence as well as their core skills.
And I fully agree with everything you say. My only pushback is, if you lack emotional maturity, you're not admitting to that. Emotional maturity means more ego, less emotional intelligence, and I'm going to surround myself with those people, but I'm never going to take responsibility for the fact that I'm emotionally immature. I'm a great strategist and we win, is the answer.
And the problem is there that you will end up just in this spiral conversation. But guess what? You're not going to move your business forward. I think I was a classic one. I was working actually with a really big organization. And actually, we were doing a little bit of a session around mistakes. And I love it. I'll start the session by saying, who's made a mistake recently? It is tumbleweed. It's silence in the room. It's uncomfortable. And I let that moment of uncomfortableness sit. for quite some time until people are thinking, oh, you can see them sort of squirming and no one wants to talk about it. And then we run the entire session around looking at culture, looking at mistakes, really deep delving a little bit into the human frailties, the way that our brains work. We'll access that. We start to talk about when we're feeling stressed, how we start to get tunnel vision, we start to lose the bigger picture, all of those sorts of human failings. And then we start to talk about these brilliant 300 events, the 130-300. And I was like, there's such a fantastic learning opportunity. There must be some people in this room who've had a really brilliant 300 event. Can you chat about it on your tables? Oh my goodness, you cannot shut them up, because all you've done is reframe the word mistake with fantastic learning opportunity, a 300 event. And at that moment, they're talking about mistakes openly. So sometimes it's just about trying to work out how to actually get into that brain to work out and reframe negativity, or I'm a strategist and this is my issue, to work out actually with a little bit more knowledge, you can turn your business and your strategic leading style into a much more inclusive one.
So that makes sense. It's one of those things that things are thrown around and I don't think people really grasp the meaning of them. So this idea is thrown around of psychological safety. I know in my work that oftentimes people think that psychological safety means that we all get along. And I'm like, no, that's not what psychological safety means. Psychological safety means you can safely have healthy conflict.
Yeah.
So there's two sides to this. One is we need the ability to have safety to have healthy conflict, and the emotional maturity to be willing to have conflict. Recently, I was interviewing Tim Elmore about Gen Z. One of the things he was saying in that interview is that 26 is the new 18, meaning emotional maturity. And by the way, 18 is the new 26 in authority, meaning they're very much more knowledgeable than we were 18, but they're less emotional mature. It's a really fascinating piece of insight. So now we get to, okay, well, I, being the CEO of the organization, have tried to set up this just culture that has psychological safety, but I can't get my people to step into having any conflict because they perceive all conflict as negative rather than as healthy conflict, as in healthy ways to confront each other. How do we deal with that in building this just culture?
So firstly, it's giving people tools and recognizing that to be assertive is not the same as being aggressive. So again, it all comes just from pure education, doesn't it? If you've grown up and we've come with a preconceived idea, because I didn't like living in my house when I was a child because my parents used to argue. So I think of conflict as being this real negative. I'm not saying I did, by the way. I'm giving an example. So they're going to come with this instant thought that any shouting or any disagreement is therefore negative. So if you try to educate people and reframe them to get a better result, we need different people and we need people to challenge as well. And so often I will be speaking to companies and it'll be our junior people. So often the apprentices, perhaps they've come from a different sector and they're now in this business. And they say to me afterwards, oh my goodness, I feel you've given me permission to speak up, because I have seen things constantly within this company that I kept thinking, why are they doing it like this? This is ridiculous. And there's a much better way of doing it. But I thought I was missing something. I thought I was perhaps stupid, or I didn't feel empowered to speak up. And so this whole, what does it actually feel like? What is psychological safety? It is giving people the space to actually challenge authority. And I want to give you a really good example of inaction. So we were on a mission in Iraq, and I was leading my first ever combat mission. So I was the junior pilot on my squadron. And my boss had said, Mandy, as a challenge for this mission, you're going to be the leader. So I ran the planning, the briefing, everything. We get airborne just before we basically recovered back to base, passing over the border back into Kuwait. I was engaged by a surface-to-air missile. Now it's 2 o'clock in the morning, it's pitch black. And my navigator basically shouted, break right, which is something that we had practiced hundreds of times before. So I did the maneuver and we put out some countermeasures in the form of flares. And we were very lucky. The surface-to-air missile was launched in a heat-seeking mode. It picked up our flares and it exploded about 2 miles away. But now the complexity of this mission changes completely, because we are now tasked to carry out an attack on a target. but we're quickly running out of fuel. So we're taught a decision-making model. And one of the models we're taught was something called TDODAR. How much time do you have? Well, we had 3 minutes, and I'm hoping people in your audience have a lot longer to make their decisions than 3 minutes. But the big things that they talk about in this decision-making model is if you're in a leadership position and you are now going to run through some sort of decision-making process, how often do you tell your team what you believe the problem to be? Now, if you've got cognitive diversity in your team, so the first thing is diagnose the problem. If you say this is the problem and you have a top-down approach, everyone will say, yes, that's the problem. If you ask your team what the problem is, you might find you have a different problem to the one you thought you had in the first place. So now we've established the starting point. Again, now you're going to ask your team to think about the options that they would come up with, never telling them what you think you should do first. Now they're going to do that. When you get those options coming in, we tend to pressure test them with BRAN, benefit, risk, alternative, or do nothing. So as these options are coming in, I'm very quickly going through this process. And then I, as the leader, make the decision. So this is where we talk about authentic leadership, but having the integrity and the accountability that goes with it, because that word is something that is skirted over quite a lot. And it's not collaborative decision making. It's option generation for the leader to still be accountable. Then you make the decision, assign the tasks and review it. So it's sort of moved on a little bit from OODA loop that you might have heard of in the past. And this is now used across the whole of commercial aviation as well as military aviation. I quickly ran through that cycle and we decided that, well, we were given the tasking of carrying out a weapons drop on a target, which was a retaliation attack because an aggressive act had been made towards one of the coalition forces. There were 80 aircraft airborne and suddenly the whole thing is up in the air. There was an airborne tanker in Saudi Arabia and we were running out of fuel. So we decided after consultation with the team that we would head south to get some more fuel from the tanker. It would open up our options. I got down there and it wasn't our British tanker. Ours is broken. It's been replaced by an American one that I wasn't cleared to tank from. I had never done it before in my life. And it has a really different refueling system. My boss is in my formation and I said, sir, I'm not qualified. He said, have a go. I thought, nice training environment. Why not? I had two attempts and I wasn't successful. And this is really important because in my back seat, so the Tornado is a two-seat aircraft. You have a pilot and a navigator or a weapon systems operator. I said to my navigator, I'm stopping. He said two words to me, press on. I have got 4 months of frontline flying experience and he has 8 years, yet I am the captain of the aircraft because I'm the pilot. Now, in this moment, it would have been very easy for me to think, well, he's telling me to carry on. So I should just do that because I've got less experience. But I sat there and I thought, there is no ego involved in leadership whatsoever. If I carry on trying to refuel, that's going to prevent the rest of my team from having a go. We collectively have a job to do. If it doesn't involve me at this moment due to my lack of, well, skill, training or experience, I have others more qualified. I moved across onto the wing and let my boss, my senior exec, my weapons instructor all refuel successfully. They went back into Iraq and located the target. I landed with my number four back at base feeling like a failure. And I got out the jet and I was hit by that imposter syndrome. You shouldn't be here. You failed these tests. And a hand appears on my shoulder, my navigator. He says to me, Mandy, that was a brilliant call. I said, sorry? What was the whole press on? He goes, ah, I'm really sorry. I was really emotionally involved in this entire mission. I have spent 3 years on the design, the development and the testing of a weapon that we happen to be carrying tonight. It's never been dropped in any theatre before in the world. And I'll be really honest, I just wanted to see my project through to closure and be the first person that dropped that bomb in anger. But you were not thinking like that. He said, you were thinking rationally. Now, we'd always heard this psychological safety, and I had thought it was a load of rubbish. But in that moment, I realised that I'd always been encouraged to speak up. I'd always been told that my voice was important. I'd always been told to challenge if I saw a better procedure or a better protocol. And suddenly in this moment, I had felt empowered to challenge. I was really happy to do that. And that is because that tone had been set from the moment we joined the military. Do challenge. There's going to always be a better way of doing it. And so when we talk about that ego and leadership, people assume that the military is top down, command and control, and that is never what I've seen in my experience of it.
I spoke to the US Air Force. I was brought in to speak to them several years ago, just before COVID, and spent time with the commander who had been a client of mine. I'd worked with him, I'd been guiding him. And I was shocked because I was carrying my bias. And I stood on stage and said, this is amazing for me because I'm realizing how full of shit I am. I love it when people breach my bias.
Yeah.
When you can find a way to breach my bias, because we've all got biases, and realizing that these were people who were not just following orders, which is what I thought it was all about.
Yeah.
I totally believed that. And I know that some people do do that. Let me be clear. But that wasn't the culture. That was the individuals. Some individuals want to abandon all accountability and just go, well, I was just following orders. That's different than the culture. And what you just described there, to me, personifies what I experienced. Wow, this is amazing. Like, these people are talking to me in a very different way than I expected. And I really love that. It was really cool. So thank you for that story, because that really punches that home, which I just think is really important for us to understand.
Can I add something there actually as well?
Please.
There's something that I'd love to mention on that one. So I have received an order once, and I was ordered to do something. And I sort of went, oh, that's an interesting thing, because I'd not really heard someone using it. When we debriefed afterwards, and we always debrief, he said, I had to order you because I was asking you to do something that was outside of our normal protocol. And therefore, it had to be an order because I wanted the accountability to sit on my head, not yours.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really interesting, again, to say, gosh, someone's ordering me. Now, in the military, if someone is ordering you to do it, hierarchy would dictate that you would probably do it. You can question it. And I did question it. And he said, I'm ordering you, Mandy, you carry on and do that. And it was a very interesting one. And it was because it was outside of the normal protocol, but he wanted to take the accountability himself.
I think this is one of the really interesting things that most of us don't even grasp about the military.
Yeah.
I wonder about today's military versus that military. And there's a whole bunch of questions there that we probably don't have time to go into here. But for now, what I want to ask, because we're focusing on the leadership here, what frameworks or metrics do you suggest for measuring the real impact of a just culture on safety, on performance, beyond anecdotal? What are the metrics?
Yeah, so I think you're often looking at numbers, and that is really important. So if you were to, for example, take two airlines or two businesses, and they've got exactly the same makeup, one gets 2,300 event reports coming in every month, and one gets one. Which is the safer organization? Well, it would be obvious, wouldn't it? It's the one that gets the one, because they're much safer. No, they have got a flawed culture, because these two companies and organizations are making exactly the same mistakes. It's just that this one has got a really excellent culture whereby people want to learn. And so it is about unpicking the data, not just accepting data. It's about not just the quantity, but the quality of the reports that come in as well. So that changes it from just being anecdotal to actually you can look at those ones as well and actually say, we can see those reports. But also, you can see the origin of the reports. That's really important. When I was talking about the things, others, and I, when you look at how advanced and mature a culture is on that just culture side of things, you look at it, and for example, British Airways, a major national carrier, when they introduced the just culture, they were nearly always number three. They were always the babies' things. Now they are nearly all I. I is the core of the report, and then you know you're hitting maturity. So you can literally track those by putting who is the origin, where's the origin of the report coming from.
Now, tell us about your new book, because your new book is An Officer and My Gentleman. And you wrote with your husband, and you said that there's a great deal of cognitive diversity. Tell us about that, because I think this is, again, it's part of what you and I have talked about, is that I think we get kind of scared of cognitive diversity. When people say that to me, I always say, well, I'm cognitively diverse. And they go, what do you mean? I go, I guarantee you, I don't think like you.
Yeah, exactly. And we all are diverse, aren't we? So there's so many different names that we give to all the different areas. So my husband is severely dyslexic, potentially maybe a little bit ADHD as well. But it's interesting that he had no idea that he was dyslexic until my son was diagnosed at school.
As is so often the case, isn't it? The parent finds out by their kid getting diagnosed.
He's like, oh my gosh, I can't read either. And he was like, hold on. Firstly, in the book is his school report where it was basically said, never has been someone so thick come through this school. Do not disgrace our doors again, type comments from the headmaster. So basically, Craig grew up, and my husband grew up, thinking that he was stupid. And it was only after he actually managed to join the Navy and he applied to be an airload master. And they said, well, you can't do that. And actually, he passed to become a pilot with much higher grades. He said, me, a pilot? And it was like, what? Anyway, he joined as a pilot and he got his first ever chance, having failed at every single thing he'd ever done at that stage. And so when we look at our life, so my life was, I was academically great at school. I worked hard. I fitted into the thing. I was head girl. I was sort of like golden kahunas. So he basically was the opposite end, the lowest in every set, struggled, failed everything. And yet we've ended up joining in this one flight path sort of feel to it. But we have an incredibly, looking through a telescope, almost from different ends. Any issue we come to, he challenges me. To begin with, it was a really interesting one. We've been together for 30 years now and have raised two sets of children as well. And we've not always been aligned because we think in opposite ways. And I see that. But I've really learned from him. He's really learned from me. And we've written this book in the story arc of a flight, that feeling of being on the runway at the start of a journey, you know, that metaphorically, are the switches in the right place? Is the mindset there? Tackling on fear of failure to sort of getting into the cruise, but also now we're going through turbulence. So this is going to be issues of our own making where we make our own mistakes. I talk about the just culture. I talk about threat and error management. He has been a Navy pilot, helicopters, fixed wing. He flew the Royal Squadron within the Navy, then ended up as an airline training captain, type rating instructor, examiner. He's probably the most qualified airline training captain I've ever met. He'll give people their licenses so that they can be pilots. And so he's basically become one of the most qualified people with one of the hardest starts. And something he's passionate at the moment about, which we've really incorporated into the book, is talking about competency-based training. So moving much more away from trying to practice scenarios type thing to recognizing that in our world of aviation, also within the business world, we cannot train for every eventuality. So what we're going to have to do is build up people's competencies so that they can apply those in an emotionally intelligent way to a scenario.
Building on the competencies, that's really interesting. I see two sides to that. One is, of course, fantastic in the way you just described it. And the other side of it is, I'm very good at this, leave me alone, which means I don't want to learn.
Yeah.
That's the other side of that. So talk to us about that sort of pushback that can happen on the other side of that. This is the way I've always done it, and I'm very good at it, and I'm the one who signed the $1 million deal, so bugger off, I'm not listening to you.
Well, let's put that in perspective for the airlines then. So the airlines have always done their training in the simulator and trained for exactly the same sort of emergencies, engine failure after takeoff. When was the last time we ever had an engine failure? There hasn't been one. And so actually they've started to go, hold on a minute, why are we training for things that actually we've never seen, that don't happen? We're not flying mechanical shifting aircraft in that way anymore. We're flying fly-by-wire Gen 5 aircraft that are really modern with huge redundancy. Let's stop training for things that have never happened and start to look at evidence. So they started to look at this and did a huge piece of research doing evidence-based training. So let's look at what's actually happening from the data and start training for that. Well, companies didn't want to do it because they said, but that's not the way we've done it. And so this has been huge pushback. But now we're starting to get buy-in from things like Turkish Airlines have taken it up. But this has been a massive cultural shift to look at why and how people are doing training. When they now have the evidence and they're starting to bring in evidence-based training, they're recognizing that these emergencies that people are having are really complex. And that's now they've had to bring in this competency-based training. So it's not just about assessing someone's communication skills. It's assessing, where are they? Are they ready to receive? How are they addressing it? How are they tackling conflict? How are we being assertive? Are we going to give someone some feedback? I need to give you feedback. Or are you going to say, is what I'm about to say understood, accepted, and capable of action? And so they're changing the language, and even down to how we would escalate something within the cockpit. If you've got something, you say, I'm uncomfortable, this is unsafe, stop. Use someone's name initially. So there's lots of techniques that they're really bringing in around those competencies to say we can't train for everything and therefore we need to do that.
So how does that competency translate in the leadership position?
Well, the big one there is going to be about recognizing that we have to do things differently. And that's really, really important. So you can't just always basically do it just the way it's always been done. So that's really, really important. Yeah, so it's just about recognizing, about moving it forward. So with leadership, it's about, for them, almost listening to the team around them to say, actually, we're going to have to take advice on this one. And so actually looking at what is available, having almost those challenging conversations to say we need to do things differently.
Okay. So I'm sure you're aware we are living in turbulent times. You might have noticed. It might pass you because it's pretty subtle. What thing would you have us all do that can help humanity?
I think we are in very turbulent times, actually, and it's about recognizing, I think, what we can control and what we can't control. I think that's a really big thing. So in our very small piece of the world in which we can have an impact in, it's about being the very best versions of ourselves, but also about recognizing what impact that you can have on others around you as well. And who do you need to influence or take on that journey? If it's outside of our control, we can sap our capacity completely and utterly by trying to fill this, we would call it the stress bucket, with all of these superfluous issues, macro events, world economics, but you can't have any impact on them. If you are going to be able to bring your best self to work, you've got to focus on that sphere of influence. And we hear people talking about that quite often, isn't it? But actually recognizing, where can I have an impact, and I put my attentions in the right direction.
Thank you. That's a great answer. So now let me ask you this final question. When you think about that girl in Manchester, whereabouts in Manchester?
I lived in Sale.
In Sale, okay. So think about that girl living in Sale, thinking about this idea of being a pilot, and you get to go back in time, not to give her advice, that's what everybody asks, but rather to share with her who you are and how you are. What is her reaction to who you've become?
Pride, without a doubt. She would be very proud of the person that I've become, and she would probably be quite surprised as well about where I am now compared to probably where she envisaged that she would be. I think that she would have thought that she would have dreamed about being a pilot and hopefully would have flown at some point. But the fact that I've taken that career and I've changed what I've done as a consequence, and I do believe I've had a positive impact on so many young people particularly. And I know that in quantitative data, because I do get messages daily from people saying, thank you, I have done this because of what you said or what you did. And I think to me that that is the thing that she would be the proudest of. I believe my flying career was one thing, but that ended up just being the vehicle so that I could do what I do now.
Beautiful. Well, I'm glad that you got to fulfill that dream for that little girl.
Thank you. Thanks, Dov. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's
been an absolute pleasure having you with us, and I hope you'll stay with us to the end. Again, before we go, though, let's please make sure that people can find out where to find out more about you and your books and how to book you for speaking, etc.
So it's mandyhickson.com. My books are available on Amazon or directly through my website as well, and on any social media platforms, which I'm sure that you'll be sharing as well. Thanks, Dov.
We will definitely make sure that all those links are published in the show notes. Hope you'll stay with us to the end, Mandy. And for you, dear listener, remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe also control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know that they must tap into what drives human behavior. I'm Dov Barron. I show businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their emotional source code to move their tribe. Because unified, actualized meaning is the single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for individuals and for companies. Remember, we need your help in staying relevant, so please do us a favor. I know you probably forget, but if you do it, it really makes a difference. Go to wherever it is you tune into from and just do us a favor and hit that rate and review button. Give us a 5-star rating, write something, write about your experience of listening to Mandy today. And of course, a big thank you to you for everyone who does listen on a regular basis, for sharing the show with everybody you know. Till next time, stay curious, my friends. Stay curious about taking emotional maturity to have a culture that is just, not blaming, not no blame, but actually fully accountable, seeing where you can step into it, where you can take ownership, and where you can help others do exactly the same in a really safe way. I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, and in your leadership impact. And I am out.